It's our second today of the Sylvania Seminar, and as I said yesterday, the goal of this particular seminar is to help us to learn how to live and love in God's truth and goodness and beauty, both in creation and in redemption. And our speaker, as you know, is Ken Myers, who is founder of Mars Hill Audio. And yesterday I mentioned that you could Google that, but the actual address is marshillaudio.org. And if you haven't gone there and haven't subscribed, I'm going to go ahead and push for you to do so, even though Ken has not asked me to do that. It's a fine effort that he does. Last night he gave his first lecture here at Sylvania, which was called Life, the Universe, and Everything, Why the Gospel Means More Than a Ticket to Heaven. And in that lecture, he began a discussion of a broader look at how the modern church has abandoned the idea of beauty as an aspect of a reality of God and a reality of creation. And that is something that the church had actually understood for 1,600 years or more, and was very dear to the church's heart, but it's been gradually abandoned over the past few hundred years. And so he began asking these kinds of questions. What has happened? Why have we neglected beauty? What have we lost by doing so? And is that loss important? And in his lecture, and I'm just going to summarize it for those who are not here, a few points. He said that beauty is a gift and is tied to our senses and to creation and to our view of the incarnation. That the essence of modernity is a denial of this very claim. That beauty should evoke a delight. That we are grateful to live in a world where such joys are possible. Beautiful statement, I thought. Grateful to live in a world where such joys are possible. And that much of art, whether visual or poetry or music, has become mere self-expression rather than a way to express an objective reality. That beauty cannot be based on our personal preferences, that there is a more fundamental reality behind it than that. That beauty conveys a reality that pure truth cannot. For example, that God's love, the knowledge of God's love and grace, is more like an aesthetic expression than a propositional statement. And that to understand and appreciate the beautiful, you must attend to it, you must pay attention to it, you must contemplate it. And that's going to take time, and it will not happen easily in this frantic world that we live in. And so today he comes with a second lecture. He'll have two today. First, we will have this lecture, then a question and answer session after that. That will follow by lunch, which everyone here is welcome to stay for that, and it's free. And then the second lecture that will start about 12:30. Each one will, as I said, have a question and answer period after that. Now he's going to talk about his second lecture. The second topic is this: it's personal period. Why modern culture is confused about truth, goodness, and beauty. Ken.
Morning. I left in the middle of an idea. That was a great summary. In fact, I don't think I need to say anything more. I think if we just... Are there any questions? I had begun the... As I was closing last night, I was talking about this idea of the comprehensiveness of Christ's salvation and looked at a number of texts like Colossians 1, 15 to 20. And I did want to... cite a few paragraphs from a book called Far As the Curse Is Found, A Line from Joy to the World by Isaac Watts, and the point being that redemption, as far as the curse is found, that's what's being redeemed. So there's a comprehensiveness. We sing that hymn carol or hymn every year, and I doubt that many people have stopped to think about the claim that's in that verse. Far As the Curse Is Found, the subtitle of this book is The Covenant Story of Redemption. And the theme throughout his book, and it's a book of looking at the whole of Scripture through the lens of the idea of covenant. And the very last chapter is called The Renewal of All Things. Michael Williams is the author. And I wanted to read a few paragraphs because he argues in here that since man is God's representative within creation, then man's destiny and the destiny of all creation are interlinked. We're not saved apart from the setting in which we're embedded, the setting in which we're created, the setting in which we're placed in order to thrive. And I think that idea, as my thinking on this has developed over the years, I think the idea that our souls are saved and nothing else about us is saved somehow became really implausible to me when I started thinking about the meaning of the human, and that to be human means to be embedded in a network of relationships, not just with other people, but with creation, and that our vocation as human beings is to be engaged with creation. And I don't think that the fact that we continue to have bodies into glory, the belief in the resurrection of the body, suggests that we're still going to have some kind of relationship with creation. Let me read just a couple of paragraphs of how Williams addresses this issue. He says, just as the fall of the first Adam was the ruin of the whole earthly creation, so the atoning death of the second Adam brings blessings of redemption to the entirety of creation. Someone last night mentioned Romans 8 in this connection. As man goes, so goes the world. As the second Adam goes, so goes the world. Man is not saved in abstraction from creation, but in the midst of a creation that looks forward to redemption. Indeed, our renewal is tied to the eschatological renewal of creation, which, again, we see in Romans 8, but we see it, I think, fully expressed, if mystically expressed, in the book of Revelation. We cannot separate our present spiritual regeneration from cosmic regeneration, because our present restoration to life is the first stage in the eschatological restoration of all creation to its proper vitality and relationship with God. That's what the phrase new heavens and new earth, which is used throughout the scriptures, refers to. It's interesting that phrase new heavens and new earth is used to describe an eschatological reality. And as we saw last night, that phrase, a parallel phrase, things that are in heaven and things in earth, that shows up in reference to Christ's rule and to Christ's participation in creation. Nothing has been made without him, as John says in the prologue to his gospel. Paul talks about all things being reconciled in him. So that idea, heavens and earth, suggesting not just mere spirituality, but again, a comprehensive view of Christ's participation, or Christ's role in both creation and redemption. Williams goes on, we are the first fruits. James 1:18 proclaims, he chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. Thus, the resurrection of Christ from the dead is the first fruits of a future harvest in which all reality will benefit from his saving work. The goal of redemption is nothing less than the restoration of the entire cosmos. The scope of redemption is truly cosmic. Through Christ, God determined to reconcile to himself all things, Colossians 1:20. Matthew 19:28 speaks of the renewal of all things. And the word actually is the same word that we use for regeneration, rebirth. Acts 3:21 also indicates a cosmic regeneration when it says that Jesus must remain in heaven until the time comes for God to restore everything. So these are just a couple of paragraphs from this book, and I'm encouraged that a number of authors from various denominational and theological traditions have been recovering this vision. I think it's been something eclipsed, I think, largely through the influence of, as I said last night, the Enlightenment's privatizing of faith and the Enlightenment insistence that let's just keep it personal. And that's implied in the title of my second talk. I can't remember if I said this during my lecture last night. I've said a couple times to people privately that I think I did say it in the lecture, that many Christians practice a form of faith that the ACLU would really approve of, that we, by keeping our faith private, having no public consequences, we're not a public nuisance. Now, last night, I talked about the dangers of cultural captivity, and before I get into the principal theme of today, I do want to, may not be necessary to say this, but after my talk, I thought I might want to say that we don't want to make the same mistake that early 20th century fundamentalism did. They were also concerned about cultural captivity. But the strategy that fundamentalists chose in order to avoid captivity was just to avoid culture. They were anti-culture. They ignored the arts, they eschewed involvement in politics, and they ended up embracing a kind of anti-intellectualism. And that's nothing at all like what I want to recommend. In fact, it's almost the opposite of what I want to recommend. I think the church needs to be very strongly pro-cultural. And I think our discipleship should encourage people to go out and take the consequences of their faith into every sphere of life. And be very active and aggressive in that. But we also want to be very countercultural. We don't want to take the world's way of understanding itself as an adequate way. We want to honor and develop all of the spheres of cultural experience that are legitimate expressions of our humanity. But we want to do so in a way that's faithful to the kinds of creatures we are and the kind of world that God has made. I think one of the reasons for the cultural confusion we have is we tend to think of culture as just something we want to do, that something that we choose arbitrarily according to our whims and desires. Whereas historically, culture was always understood as an effort collectively to express an agreed upon notion of what it means to be human, an agreed upon notion of the meaning of our humanity and the meaning of the world that we've been placed to live in. Now, for 200 years, secular culture has denied that there is any such thing as human nature or a nature to nature. And sadly, Christians, again, with a privatized faith, have gone along with that rather than saying, no, there is a nature to nature. There is a nature to human nature. For me, the gay marriage debate is kind of the big case study of what happens when you deny a nature to nature and a nature to human nature. And so this is not just about sexuality. It's about a bigger question of whether there's an order in the nature of things that will determine how we live and that will determine our laws. I just read this morning that military chaplains have been given the right to supervise gay marriages, which... Well, I won't talk anymore about that. So rather than being anti-cultural, the solution to this isn't just to withdraw, you know, pull up the drawbridge or put the wagons in a circle or whatever sorts of escapist metaphor you prefer. The solution is to cultivate a rich understanding of our own about what culture would look like. I spoke to a group of folks earlier this week and said that let's imagine everybody got saved tomorrow. How would we live Monday morning? A lot of our thinking about culture is shaped by our concerns for evangelism. Let's set that aside for a minute and ask, if we weren't worried about that, on what criteria will we use to establish norms for cultural life? So we need to be very thoughtful and aggressive in doing that. If philosophers are confused about the nature of truth, we don't abandon philosophy. We try to become better philosophers. If educators are confused about the role of reason and education in life, we don't abandon schooling. We create better schools and train better teachers. If artists are confused about the question of beauty, as many 20th century artists have been, we don't boycott the arts. We encourage and train better artists who are eager to recover wisdom and practices from the past that have been lost, and eager to discover and portray in their work previously unexplored aspects of God's created order. The New Testament is very clear about the necessity of avoiding worldliness, and I think it's a theme we really need to recover. Unfortunately, fundamentalists said the way to avoid worldliness is to try to get out of the world, period. We don't have the option of avoiding worldliness by abandoning cultural life any more than we should avoid licentiousness and lust by neutering ourselves or forgetting about the possibilities of love. I mean, it's one way, but I don't think it's a very good way. Now, on to the lectures. I'll try not to make these R-rated. There are no kids here. But title for the talk, It's Personal, Period. And I've already suggested where this is going. Why modern culture is confused about truth, goodness, and beauty. And I promised last night that I'd talk a little bit this morning about the attributes of beauty without giving a complete or comprehensive definition. I come into this with fear and trembling because we're dealing with very difficult and deep things. And there's no single way to get at the meaning of beauty, so I'm going to try to suggest multiple paths. And I'll start with one that may be a bit more graspable than some of the others, especially for those of you who've grown up as Baptists. There's a hymn from the mid-19th century called We're Marching to Zion. How many know We're Marching to Zion? Okay, that's good. I was hoping there'd be at least a majority here. I grew up singing this. Although in the Anglican Church, it's not in our hymnal, I'll have to say. The music was written in 1867 by a Baptist minister born in Philadelphia, actually, named Robert Lowry. He wrote the music, and he wrote the refrain, but he stole all the verses from Isaac Watts. And if you're going to plagiarize, Isaac Watts is about the best that you can take from. I mean, if you're going to steal material, take it from the best. The refrain, we're marching to Zion, beautiful, beautiful Zion. We're marching upward to Zion, the beautiful city of God. There's only one adjective in all four lines of that refrain, and it's beautiful. And beautiful, beautiful Zion. He has to repeat it, kind of like the Hebrew language, when it wants to accentuate something, repeats it. We're marching upward to Zion, the beautiful city of God. He uses this three times just in case we missed the point. Stephen Guthrie, in his recent book called Creator Spirit, observes that in ordinary Christian piety, there seems to be an intuitive connection between beauty and the new creation. Christians voice their hope in the dialect of beauty. They've read of a city prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. A city of pure gold, clear as glass. Those images are images of a kind of primal, instinctual beauty. Given the biblical cues like these, Christians commonly associate heavenly realities with beauty. And conversely, beauty has often been associated with something like eschatological fulfillment. And he goes on to quote a number of critics and artists. He says, when speaking of beauty or great art, critics and artists reach for the language of transcendent completion. Even people don't believe in heaven or don't believe in God. He quotes a contemporary critic who describes approvingly the 20th century German artist Josef Beuys as an artist with a scheme for transforming the world, who sets out through art spiritually to reconstitute man's unity. This is, again, a secularist critic who has to use language that sounds eschatological to describe the particular kind of beauty in Beuys's work. A number of theologians have suggested that earthly beauty points to God and or to a glorified world. Abraham Kuyper writes, Kuyper was a Dutch Reformed theologian and also an educator and politician. Kuyper wrote, art has the mystical task of reminding us in its productions of the beautiful that was lost and of anticipating its perfect coming luster. Art points out both the still visible lines of the original plan and, what is even more, the splendid restoration by which the supreme artist and master builder will one day renew and enhance the beauty of his original creation. Anglican Bishop Richard Harries similarly writes that the beauty of that final state of affairs, the new heaven and new earth, is reflected even now in the beauty of our world and in works of art. So this is a very common theme among, from Baptists to Anglicans and secularists. By the way, that idea of a lost beauty, a restored and more glorious beauty, something related to both being experienced now, that we're experiencing a recovery of a lost beauty, but we're also anticipating a more glorious beauty. That's actually present in some of the verses of We're Marching to Zion. I went online and looked. It's often the case that hymnals and hymn writers will take, three or four verses of a longer poem, and you never hear the whole poem. And it's interesting to look and find out what are the missing verses? What haven't we been singing all these years? And Watts's poem was quite a bit longer. And it was a poem written in 1707. Here are a few that I don't remember singing. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention. The sorrows, and unlike the hymn, which repeats the third and fourth line of each stanza, Watts's poem didn't do that originally, so I'll read it without the repeats, and so we won't sing it. The sorrows of the mind be banished from the place. Religion never was designed to make our pleasures less. We'll put that on a bumper sticker, okay? Religion never was designed to make our pleasures less. The mention of Watts here of pleasure certainly has resonance with the idea of beauty, which has always been linked with delight. And in two of the later verses, Watts suggests that those eschatological delights, the beauty of a fulfilled redemption, are already anticipated in our experience now. The men of grace have found glory begun below. Celestial fruits on earthly ground from faith and hope may grow. In other words, we don't just wait for the eschaton. We don't wait for the fulfillment. The glory starts now, he says. And then the next verse, the hills of Zion yields 1,000 secret sweets before we reach the heavenly fields or walk the golden streets. Don't put off till tomorrow what you can enjoy today. Okay, that's what Watts is saying. This has already started to happen. Now, we didn't sing those verses. Wonder if the piety of the churches I grew up in would be different if we sang those verses and people started reflecting on that. Those images of gold, of sweets, of celestial fruit all suggest, again, a kind of beauty. Stephen Guthrie, again in his book Creator Spirit, argues that it's proper to associate beauty with God's redemptive work. A Christian eschatology asserts that history, humanity, and the cosmos look forward not only to an ending, but to a telos, that is, to completion, to fulfillment, and a kind of perfection. To hope for the kingdom of God in its fullness is to hope for beauty. Perfection, fullness, wholeness has for centuries been one of the key attributes of beauty. It's the first attribute listed by Thomas Aquinas in a short passage that's often cited, who's one of the theologian philosophers whose work is very often cited as basic in Christian thinking about beauty. Aquinas is in the 13th century. Aquinas wrote that beauty includes three conditions, integrity or perfection. And remember, these English translations, they're translations of Latin words, which could be variously translated. So what I'm reading is one English rendering of his. And so there are a lot of synonyms that show up. Integrity or perfection, since those things which are impaired are by that very fact ugly, just states that. Due proportion or harmony is the second aspect of beauty. And lastly, brightness or clarity. And that the word used, claritas, there has also been frequently translated as radiance. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Now, let's look quickly at these three points. Perfection or integrity. Beautiful things give the impression of being complete, of lacking in nothing. And so they have that resonance with eschatological fulfillment, with the completion that is God's fulfilling of redemption. The great Renaissance architect Alberti defined beauty, and he here combines two of Aquinas' themes. He defined beauty as a sort of chordal combination, chordal, like the playing of a chord, where all the parts resonate. A harmony between the different units which does not allow anything to be added or taken away without having an injurious effect upon the whole. A building that if you hadn't added just that last little detail, would look incomplete. Or if you'd added too many extra things, would also look incomplete, wouldn't look perfect, have too much. The language of beauty about something being injured reminds us that beauty isn't on a binary quality. It's not a binary quality. That is, Beauty is experienced on a sliding scale. Some things are more beautiful than others. An artist may realize that his work may be more beautiful by adding this or that component. Or a critic might perceive how a work had failed to achieve a fuller potential because some aspect is less than fully developed. Harmony, or due proportion, is the second aspect that Aquinas lists, and it refers to the way that various elements in a work of art or in a natural artifact are interrelated in a manner that seems fitting or balanced. And again, this stuff isn't measurable. There's not a spreadsheet for this. That may bother some of you, but deal with it. The third aspect is brightness or clarity or radiance. Not literal brightness, necessarily, but a radiance of expression or execution. You can read a poem that has a brightness about it because of, and often in the case of poetry, it's bright vowel sounds, like I's and E's, rather than O's and O's. It sounds dark. In music, you can have a brightness or clarity or radiance that's achieved through tone color or through the use of rhythmic or melodic elements. In Bach's St. Matthew Passion, famously, every time Jesus sings one of his recitatives or arias, one of the recitatives, I should say, Bach has what's been called the halo effect. He has strings playing this little chord above the other music. Every time he sings, there's this little halo, this little bright thing that accompanies him, except when he's on the cross and he sings for the first time and the halo, the brightness is gone. And it's, if you've been paying attention, it's pretty dramatic when suddenly that brightness disappears, when he says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Stephen Guthrie believes that this attribute in Aquinas' depiction of the elements of beauty ought to be associated with pleasure, that it's the brightness that gives us pleasure. I'm not sure that I would isolate pleasure with just the one element. Aquinas himself in another passage says, beautiful things are those which please when seen, hence beauty consists in due proportion for the senses delight in things duly proportioned. So there, Aquinas himself associates pleasure with proportion or harmony. So now someone might object, well, who's to say what is duly proportioned? What defines fittingness? Well, it turns out that one can begin to find patterns and even ratios in nature and in art or architecture that people find pleasing. I said there's no spreadsheet, but actually there is some measurements we can do under some circumstances. For example, many of you may have heard of the golden ratio or the golden section or the golden rectangle. There's a value equal roughly to 1.618, and it's an irrational number, so we could go on all day defining it, but roughly 1.618 or 1.6. If you have a rectangle, it's designated, by the way, by the Greek letter phi. That value, we know what pi is, and we use pi to calculate the areas of a circle or other things. But we don't think about phi, but it turns out phi, the value of phi, is very much involved with our sense of beauty. If you had a rectangle in which the long dimension is 1.6 times the shorter side, you get what's called a golden rectangle, and it turns out that that shape is seen in all kinds of things that people have for millennia thought of as beautiful. Egyptian pyramids, the Parthenon, medieval cathedrals. Leonardo uses it. 20th century painter Mondrian uses it. I saw a thing online recently. Apple computers had a new logo for their iCloud service, and someone figured out that the configuration of the four circles in the clouds actually reflect a golden rectangle. Really cool. So some Japanese guy figured that out. So this is not peculiar to the Western world, okay? For some reason, and some poor evolutionary psychologist is probably trying to figure out this in terms of survival value. Don't ask why. Ours is not to reason why. Ours is just to enjoy it. Somehow it's pleasurable. we take delight in. And a lot of art reflects that. And that does give a sense of due proportion or harmony somehow when that number is reflected. I'm going to mention two books if you're intrigued by this, those of you with a slightly more mathematical bent, perhaps. There's a book by Stratford Caldicott, who's a Christian, who has a wonderful little book that I'd recommend even if he didn't deal with this, called Beauty for Truth's Sake. And he actually spends several chapters talking about geometry and the geometry of beauty. And then another book that just deals with the golden ratio, Mario Livio, L-I-V-I-O, and it's a book called The Golden Ratio, subtitled The Story of Phi, the World's Most Astonishing Number. It's a wonderful little book. It turns out that there is a general unanimity that does emerge about judgments of beauty. Architect and designer Christopher Alexander, any of you know of his work? He's done some amazing stuff. He designs buildings, and he's done a lot of research to figure out what kinds of things do people find pleasant, what kind of dimensions work best in a room for kids versus rooms for older people, what kinds of rooms work best in rooms where you have food versus rooms where you're lounging around. And he's done an amazing amount of work putting together a kind of dictionary or vocabulary of formal structures that seem to have a universal resonance in people's lives. And basically says, you know, if you don't pay attention to these things, you're going to build ugly buildings, or you're going to build buildings that people don't enjoy being in. And if you do some research into the buildings that people really like and really like to be in, you find that they do have similarities. Now, he's also, Alexander's also developed a test to train people to be much more deliberate in the perception of beauty. And in one of these tests, he asks people a series of questions. He chooses two objects at random. I don't know, maybe this and this, okay? And then he asks a series of questions. He says, which is the more attractive of the two objects? Which do you like best? Why do you like it? It's the second question. Third question. Which gives you the most wholesome feeling? Now, listen, that's the first three. Listen to the next three. Which of them better represents your whole self? If you had a choice, which would you spend eternity with? Kind of up in the ante here. Which of them would you be happier to offer to God? Now, the amazing thing is, these last three questions, which represents your whole self, which would you spend eternity with, which would you want to offer to God? When he asked those three questions of a big group of students, 90% of the students agree. No matter what the objects, he'll choose, you know, various pairs of objects. And it turns out no matter what the pair is, if you ask questions in that's a really serious way, and people think about it, they tend to gravitate towards the same thing, 90% agreement. 90% agreement is pretty high statistically, it would seem to me. Whereas on the first three, the distribution is pretty much random. What's the most attractive of the two items? Which do you like best? And it turns out that turns out to be kind of random. But when you start asking questions about significance, and particularly eternal significance, suddenly people tend to go in the same direction. Isn't that interesting? But beauty, of course, is subjective, right? Now, I want to explore the question of objectivity of beauty a little bit more, but let me mention a more philosophical approach to beauty. And this is a little difficult because we're talking about metaphysics, and many of us are on the threshold of confusion at this point. Beauty is traditionally identified as one of the properties called transcendentals, properties that are universal, that is, properties that transcend the particularity of particular things. It's a quality that applies to everything. Truth, goodness, and beauty are often listed as transcendentals. Unity is often listed as well. And Christian theologians have argued that the transcendentals are evident in creation because they're attributes of God. And creation not only reflects God's nature, like the design of this watch may reflect the character of the guy who designed it, but creation is actually being held together by God in Christ. Paul writes in Colossians, all things hold together in him. Creation does not have a coherence of its own apart from God's presence. Ephesians 1 speaks of Christ as filling everything in every way. Isaiah 6:3 says the whole earth is full of God's glory. So we shouldn't be surprised to discover that the attributes of God are present in a creation that's suffused with his presence. As I suggested last night, creation is an act of God's love and pleasure. One of the problems of modern thought, including, I think, a lot of modern theology, is that theists began to speak of creation as an act of God's sheer will. He did it because he willed it. Well, it's true that he did it because he willed it. But if you leave out love and pleasure as part of the as attributes of God that have relevance to his work of creation, you get a different kind of universe. You get a universe that's harsher. You get a universe that's, in a sense, more arbitrary. And that idea that God's will is his ultimate attribute and not love or justice or other attributes, that shift, which occurs, actually, it starts showing up in late medieval theology, has profound consequences in how we think about ourselves. When we think of God as sheer will, a God who can actually be capricious, and actually some theologians in the 14th century were saying, if God declared tomorrow that fornicators were righteous and those who were faithful to their spouses were to be condemned, he has to have the right to do that. So God begins to be depicted as a capricious God, and will is his ultimate attribute. Love, justice, goodness, beauty, all of those other things begin to disappear. And what happens to our picture of human nature? Well, if we think of God as principally will, then we start to think of human beings as principally will. And we end up with what Friedrich Nietzsche calls the triumph of the will. That's a 2-minute summary of the last 600 years of thought. Okay. Creation is an act of God's love and pleasure. In that sense, it is a beautiful act. When God confirms after each day of creation that what he has made is good, he's confirming the beauty that's present in creation. It is God's structuring of creation that guarantees the objectivity of beauty. Augustine describes God himself as absolute beauty, the principle and source of all that is beautiful in the world. Jonathan Edwards argued that beauty is rooted in who God is, that, quote, all the beauty to be found throughout the whole creation is but the reflection of the diffused beams of that being who hath an infinite fullness of brightness and glory. God is the foundation and fountain of all being and beauty. I have to bring Edwards in here because some of you with Reformed backgrounds get a little nervous about all this fuzzy talk about beauty. Well, I'll just appeal to Edwards at that point. Orthodox theologian David Bentley Hart reminds us that Jonathan Edwards called the Holy Spirit the beautifier, the one in whom the happiness of God overflows and is perfected precisely as overflowing, and so the one who bestows radiance, shape, clarity, and enticing splendor upon what God creates and embraces in the superabundance of his love. That's a quick summary of Edwards' view. I recently got a book that I'm looking forward to reading. I just discovered it, didn't know about it recently. That's an entire treatise which argues that Edwards' understanding of beauty is the most fundamental theme that organizes all of his theology. Now, I want to move to discuss this question of objectivity of beauty, and I'm going to bring David Bentley Hart in again to introduce the question in his magnificently difficult book, The Beauty of the Infinite. He argues against certain postmodern theorists, and he argues that beauty is a category that's indispensable to Christian thought. All that theology says of the triune life of God, The gratuity of creation, as I said last night, creation is a gift. God didn't have to do it. It's gratuitous. All the theology says of the triune life of God, the gratuity of creation, the incarnation of the Word, the salvation of the world, makes room for, indeed depends upon, a thought and a narrative of the beautiful. In the introductory chapter, Hart sketches out some statements about the nature of beauty, and he first insists that beauty is objective. Now, he's so difficult. I'm going to read a sentence. Each sentence I'll probably have to explain a little bit. He says, it's asserted that beauty is objective with neither any dogma nor any science of the beautiful in view. There is no objective thing that can be isolated, described, and quantified in the manifold experience whose name is beauty. You can't extract, oh, yeah, there's the beauty thing. Let's pull that out and we can use that somewhere else. He's saying, no, to say it's objective doesn't mean that. Nonetheless, beauty possesses a phenomenal priority. Phenomenal priority. We use the word phenomenal to mean just it's amazing, right? I think he means as the experience of a phenomenon, we experience different phenomena when we say look at a painting or we look at a sunset or we read a piece of prose. Now, we read a piece of prose, it may also convey something true to us. But by saying beauty has a phenomenal priority, I think he means that often, if not always, if we perceive something that's both true and beautiful, the beauty hits us first. The beauty hits us hardest. So it has a kind of priority in our experience. It appears on the vastest of scales and on the most minute, at once familiar and strange, near and remote. Attempts to make it obedient to a particular semantics inevitably fail and expand uncontrollably into an ever more inexact prolixity. Okay, he's saying the more we talk about it, the more we have to say. we try to describe it, we end up just kind of infinitely going on. Because we can't ever entirely contain it. The beautiful is not a fiction of desire. That is, it's not just an expression of what we desire ourselves. Nor is its nature exhausted by a phenomenology of pleasure. That is, we can't just say. In fact, Augustine says this. Something is not beautiful because it gives us pleasure, but it gives us pleasure because it is beautiful. I'll let you think about the difference between those two things later. Write that down. There is an overwhelming givenness in the beautiful, and it is discovered in astonishment, in an awareness of something fortuitous, adventitious, essentially indescribable. That idea that there's a givenness and yet we discover it in astonishment. I've listened to, for instance, pieces by Bach, and I know Hart loves Bach, where you get the sense that, yes, that's exactly as it had to be. But at the same time, how in the world did he ever do that? And I think that's the case with a lot of experience of beauty. On the one hand, you're astonished and surprised and shocked. But on the other hand, you have the sense that it's, yes, that's exactly right. Exactly right. And I think that may be similar to what the disciples experienced from time to time with Jesus. What our experience of divinity is like. This priority and fortuitousness allows theology to hear in the advent of beauty the declaration of God's goodness and glory, and to see in the attractiveness of the beautiful that creation is invited to partake of that goodness and glory. And so say the Psalms, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good." It's not just compute that the Lord is good, calculate that the Lord is good, conclude that the Lord is good, but no, that's not adequate. Taste and see. You have to participate and you have to delight in it. In Psalm 19, we're told that God's laws are like honey from the honeycomb. More beautiful than gold. The psalmist has to resort to appeals to beauty, and a beauty perceived by the senses in order to describe an aspect of God's laws. Now, one could try to formulate an abstract description to summarize what's meant by the honey and the gold, but it's, I don't think you'd do better than the inspired Word of God. Okay? It turns out that's what the Holy Spirit thought was the best way to describe it. So let's not try to do a better job, okay? There's a lot more from Hart, but I would love to spend the rest of the day expositing him, but I think I need to move on. So I'm going to skip a few pages here. One other phrase: creation's open and overwhelming declaration of God's glory. He talks here about how scriptures regularly remind us of creation's open and overwhelming declaration of God's glory, the beauty that fills and upholds heavens and earth, the divine goodness that expresses itself in light, flesh, and form. So I was working on these lectures, I started thinking about all of the texts, and here is a suggestion for a Bible study. All of the texts that describe God in terms of light, and why is that particular image used? Again, this gets to the idea of radiance that Aquinas uses. He's the father of lights. John says in him was light, and the light was the life of men. I mean, just do a Bible study sometime of all the imagery of light, and then you have things like what happens in the Transfiguration. Again, I don't think that you can reduce that image to a purely rationalistic summary. I think you really need ideas of beauty. There's a lot more I could bring in from David Bentley Hart, but I want to move on, and I want to borrow some observations from a teacher named Robert Mills, who wrote in a newsletter distributed to Presbyterian pastors a short essay recently called "Beauty, the Beholder, and the Believer," and he starts by saying, "True or false, beauty is in the eye of the beholder." When I ask my Christian college students that question, the overwhelming majority instantly answer true. Although these classes have 150 students or more, I've never needed both hands to count the number who answer false. When I ask those who answer true why they believe beauty is in the eye of the beholder, I get responses like, someone might like something, but someone else might not like the same thing, and no one can tell another person what's beautiful. It is when I ask those who give this last answer, why not, that the conversation gets interesting. He doesn't explain why it's interesting. Later in this essay, he talks about what he summarizes as the objective view of beauty. The idea that beauty is objective. And he points out that while they may, and this is, I'm reading this because he's done a great job at summarizing a lot of things very simply. While they may have disagreed about the criteria and the ultimate nature of beauty, Pythagoras, Plato, and Aristotle all acknowledge that beauty is a quality of the object itself. This is known as the objective view of beauty. To say that beauty is an objective quality is to say that that which makes an object beautiful is a quality of the object itself, not the subject perceiving it. The opposite of the objective view of beauty is the subjective view, which holds that the one viewing the object, that is the subject, determines whether the object is or is not beautiful. Those who hold to a subjective view of beauty insist that there is nothing whatsoever in the object that determines whether or not the object is rightly described as beautiful. Now listen to this next statement. The objective view of beauty was almost universally accepted from the time of Plato until the Enlightenment. So, what, 400, 4th, 5th century B.C. to the 18th century. It's a pretty long stretch of time, okay? A lot of smart people in there, a lot of them Christians. Mills observes that the objective view of beauty was also held by the authors of the Bible. And then he goes on and looks at a number of passages. And then he has an interesting citation from Calvin's Institutes. In which he's affirming the objectivity of beauty, the fact that God put it there. God put it there. Now, if we ponder to what end God created food, we shall find that he meant not only to provide for necessity, but also for delight and good cheer. Yeah. Calvin. Getting mellow here. Thus, the purpose of clothing, apart from necessity, was comeliness and decency. Yeah, Calvin. In grasses, trees, and fruits, apart from their various uses, beauty of appearance and pleasantness of odor. God made it that way. Okay? And the natural qualities themselves of things demonstrate sufficiently to what end and extent we may enjoy them. Has the Lord clothed the flowers with great beauty that greets our eyes, the sweetness of smell that is wafted upon our nostrils, and yet will it be unlawful for our eyes to be affected by that beauty, or our sense of smell by the sweetness of that odor? What? Did he not so distinguish colors as to make some more lovely than others? Did he not endow gold and silver, ivory and marble, with a loveliness that renders them more precious than other metals and stones? Did he not, in short, render many things attractive to us apart from their necessary use? This is a really, really important point Calvin's making, and it's something we often neglect because we are so conditioned by a materialistic view and by evolutionary views to think that the shape of things and the smell of things and the color of things is just expressive of some necessity in nature, and that our engagement with them is to be governed only by necessity in our meeting our own needs, without realizing that God has placed this there. I moved to the country 20 some years ago, partly to improve my imagination. And I remember one epiphany morning when I'm walking along and I suddenly think, why did God make so many different interesting shapes of bark? That I take delight in looking at, we have these hickory trees that have a particular complex wavy bark shape. And then we have different pine trees that have these overlapping layers of bark. We have something called a shagbark hickory, which looks kind of like it's imitating pine trees. And there's a peculiar delight to the texture and shape and color of each of these forms of bark. Now, I'm sure you could explain it in purely botanical terms. But to deny that God has providentially ordered this way so that we might delight in it, that the scent of the flowers doesn't just serve some survival value, but actually serves to give us an opportunity for delight. Calvin's saying, no, you've got to keep God's presence in conveying that in your understanding of these things. Now, having brought botanists into it, the shift toward a subjective view of beauty begins with the rise of modern science, in part because modern science is striving to explain everything in purely natural terms, in terms that can be entirely quantified. And philosophers, following along the same line, as I mentioned Descartes last night, and actually Immanuel Kant, late 18th century, is probably the most eager to insist that beauty is just how we feel about something, not something that's actually present and purposeful in the thing itself. So, beginning at the time of the Enlightenment, there's a series of shifts in thinking that exclude revelation and God himself as sources of understanding reality. In time, the seeds planted during the Enlightenment would result in the conclusion that truth and goodness are also subjective, that what's true for you may not be true for me, that goodness is in the eye of the beholder. That's where our culture has arrived now. It took a little while to get there. But beauty kind of gave up first. Quickly, a few ideas to describe the devolution of ideas about creation and reason and self that led to the denial of the objectivity of truth, goodness, and beauty. So, a sociologist named Daniel Bell, who died in the past year, who's a brilliant observer of modern culture, he defined what it means to be modern in terms of a sense of openness to change and a readiness, if not eagerness, to welcome the new, even at the expense of tradition and the past. To be modern is to embrace the proposition that there are no ends or purposes given in nature, that the individual and his or her own self-realization is the new standard of judgment, and that one can remake oneself and remake society in an effort to achieve those goals. There is a single theme that focuses all of the distinctly modern movements in culture, and that is the rejection of a revealed order or natural order, and the substitution of the individual as the lodestar of consciousness. He goes on to describe this as a social reversal of the Copernican revolution. You know, the Copernican revolution shifts the earth from the center of things out orbiting. So the earth is no longer the center of things. He says, this is a social reversal. If our planet is no longer the center of the physical universe and our earthly habitat is diminished in the horizons of nature, the self takes the throne as the center of the moral universe. It sounds like he's been reading a Four Spiritual Laws tract here. I doubt that he was. Making itself the arbiter of all decisions. There are no doubts, he says, in the modern world, there are no doubts about the moral authority of the self. That is simply taken as a given. The only question is what constitutes fulfillment of the self. As modernity made the self the center of the moral universe rather than natural law or cosmic order or divine purpose, that affected a change in how we understand the nature of the cosmos. The self-centered idea of modernity is linked to the assumption that the universe is made up of inherently meaningless stuff, just raw material for projects of our own devising. It may be mathematically decipherable, but it's morally and spiritually mute. So the delight that we perceive from the flowers and the shape of the bark or the colors, that's not really significant, and it's not really there. It's something we're reading into creation in some way. C.S. Lewis has an essay called The Empty Universe, where he talks about the progression in thought that, in a sense, makes our perception of reality much more of a mechanism. At the outset, the universe appeared packed with will and intelligence and life and positive qualities. Yet the advance of knowledge gradually empties this rich and genial universe, first of its gods, then of its colors, smells, sounds, and tastes, and finally of solidity itself, as solidity was imagined. The same method which has emptied the world, that is, which has said all of those things that you value and delight in the world, they're just things you're imposing. They're not really there. The same method which has emptied the world now proceeds to empty ourselves. The masters of the method soon announced that we were just as mistaken when we attributed souls or selves or minds to human organisms as when we attributed dryads to the trees. So again, this kind of reductionism where everything gets reduced down to basically chemistry and physics. That starts with the external world and then proceeds to describe human nature. I'm going to skip some of the material prepared and summarize that pre-modern men and women lived in a world that was often threatening and baffling, but it was full of purpose and meaning and beauty, however obscure or mysterious. Modern men and women live in a world that is meaningless, but it's a lot more manageable. It's much more subjected to our wills through science and technology. Modernity bargains away meaning for power. There's still the possibility of meaning for modern people, but we assume that it's private. So in our public institutions are not governed by overarching systems of meaning, by the recognition that there's meaning in the nature of things. Our public institutions are governed by notions that life is just a mechanism. And that's a profound disorder. I am going to stop there. And what's the agenda? Am I on time here, roughly? Okay. Actually, can I read one more passage? Since I'm not late yet, and I will be. I've alluded to because truth, goodness, and beauty are substantively interrelated. You can't dispense with an idea of objectivity of beauty without inevitably starting in the direction of denying the objectivity of truth and goodness. And Hans Urs von Balthasar is a Swiss theologian who's written some of the most magnificent works on theological aesthetics. Has observed in this, and in one of his books, he says, "Our situation today shows that beauty demands for itself at least as much courage and decision. That is, we have to be courageous and decisive to defend beauty, as do truth and goodness. And she will not allow herself to be separated and banned from her two sisters without taking them along with her in an act of mysterious vengeance." I love this. In a world without beauty, even if people cannot dispense with the word and constantly have it on the tip of their tongues in order to abuse it, in a world which is perhaps not wholly without beauty, but which can no longer see it or reckon with it, can't account for it, in such a world, the good also loses its attractiveness. The self-evidence of why it must be carried out. Man stands before the good and asks himself why it must be done and not rather its alternative evil. See what he's saying here. We're attracted to the good because it's beautiful. Similarly with truth. In a world that no longer has confidence in itself to affirm the beautiful, the proofs of the truth have lost their cogency. In other words, syllogisms may still dutifully clatter away like rotary presses or computers which infallibly spew out an exact number of answers by the minute. But the logic of these answers is itself a mechanism which no longer captivates anyone. The very conclusions are no longer conclusive. So the subtraction of beauty, the alienation, the marginalization of beauty, the failure of confidence in the objectivity of beauty bring us to a kind of denuded world in which neither goodness or truth have the kind of compelling power. We're not as likely to desire the truth or to desire goodness. If beauty is eliminated, we attribute our desire for truth and goodness. We try to rationalize it away. We try to reduce it to some kind of social conditioning, or we've been brainwashed somehow, or possibly we have some sort of neurological disorder which could be medicated, and then we'll not be as concerned about truth and goodness. So I think he points that crisis of the loss of objectivity. I think he points to it very wisely. I will stop then. Now we're gonna are we Q&A now? Or we take. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll give it absolutely incomprehensible answers if you do that.
I'll be glad to.